It's time to travel to the next room with Jane Asher, an exploration of the bigger picture surrounding life on Earth and what follows. Now, here's your host, Jane Asher, on Empower Radio.
It's always a complete joy for me to be able to express myself and to get on the air and just talk to interesting people that have fascinating stories. My guest tonight, oh my gosh, wow, I don't even know where to start. This man has had a career that is so expansive and so firmly cemented in his truth and integrity that it was just a complete honor to be able to have him on the show. His name is Michael On Fire. He is a singer, songwriter, uncompromised musician. He has refused to let go of his dignity and integrity in a very difficult business, which is the music industry. There's been a recent documentary on his career. It's called The Artist, The Dreamer, The Lover, The Fool. I loved it. I watched the entire thing. Just really fascinating. And a new soundtrack too, Where Dreamers Only Go. Michael has recorded over 18 records. What I hear is raw honesty with his music. If you want to know more about Michael, please go to michaelonfire.com. So without further ado, my guest this evening, Michael, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Let me start this thing out. I woke up this morning, and I've been along here my whole life, right? This morning, I got up, and I walked into my bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I pulled out scissors, and I cut 6 inches off of my hair all around.
No.
Yeah, I've never done that before. I mean, like, I'm like this. I've got this mane, this wild mane forever, and all of a sudden, I just cut all my... I cut 6 inches off my hair. I'm still somewhat of a long hair, but now I look like so different. I don't even recognize myself. So if I am speaking in tongues or anything like that, it's because I'm not here anymore. So
okay. So I'm just really curious. What provoked you to take the scissors out and get rid of this beautiful mane of hair that you've had, which is kind of been a defining piece? I mean, if you go to michaelonfire.com and you look at the pictures of him, this guy's got a head of hair that won't quit. And you've had it since you were a young man.
Yeah, I've had it for, 51 years now, right? And it's just, I don't know. I just, circumstances surrounding me the last several days have become so brutal and so weird that I just, you know, it's like that old Springsteen line. I want to change my face, my whatever,
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, I woke up and I did that and God, I lost my mind momentarily and I did it.
That's okay.
So rather than looking like Robert Plant, now I look more like Bob Dylan. So,
You know what? It's funny you should say Bob Dylan, because after I watched the documentary and I've been listening to your music nonstop, I wrote down sort of like this treasured, sort of undiscovered version of Bob. Like, that's what I get. Your lyrics are so freaking cool and so deep and so multi-layered. And I'm like, why is this guy not this massive superstar? But then when you look back on everything you've done, you are a massive superstar. It's just you traveled in a very different circle. So you're from Detroit. You did.
And if you've ever been to Detroit, Detroit is, it's like a hard rock town. It's Motown.
It's all terrible.
And when I was growing up, I was one of the very few people to even know Bob Dylan in this town. Everybody knew Ted Nugent, but they didn't really. I mean, everybody heard the name Bob Dylan because Bob Dylan, of course, is the greatest, force maybe in my lifetime.
Amen,
minute I heard Bob Dylan, it's just like, boy, did he put a different perspective on things, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, as opposed to singing oh, my girlfriend, you know, I love the way she looks and all that, you know.
Hey, you know what? Buckets of Rain is one of my all-time favorite songs.
Yes.
So she's just so brilliant. So, well, you know, Michael, so here you are. You've got, you know, you have this extraordinary career, and you've worked with, I mean, for goodness sakes, we're in the studio with Stephen Stills. I'm like, this is incredible that Stephen
was.
Well,
that was pretty profound, you know, going into a studio with Stephen, because Stephen, you know, he took me into a studio, and he was a bona fide, massive, massive superstar. I mean, he's great musician, great singer, great songwriter. And I mean, from the time he was 18, he's been a massive star. So he was on a whole different level. I could barely even understand anything about him because he was in such a different plane of existence, you know? But it was an honor. It was obviously an honor. But it was very difficult being in there because Stephen had a very, he had a very interesting time. He was a major star, but his stardom was contingent upon his partners, David and Graham, you know. It was an equality. It was a democracy.
Right.
And Stephen was one third a part of that. And me being Michael, I mean, my real name is Michael Colon. I've had to change my name. I had to change my name to Michael on Fire because that record contract I signed, they owned my name. And they forbid me from using my own name. And I couldn't out-lawyer these people.
Yeah, of course not.
So I was so burning up that I changed my name to Michael on Fire. And as a matter of fact, I remember when I did that. You know, my dad says, what's wrong with you? How come? Why don't you take your own name? And people were saying, oh, you think you're so cool, Michael on Fire. What are you, so hot? You know, and it was almost like I did it to escape. Because if they knew where I was playing, Michael Colon was playing, many gigs I'd go to, even out in L.A. or Colorado, wherever I was at, somebody would show up and try to prevent me from playing. Have an injunction against me because I was not allowed to do anything without their permission, you know?
It's just wrong. It's just wrong.
Totally wrong, yeah.
Yeah, it's really what is very upsetting about the record industry. But, you know, let's get back on a path of what is good. And what is good is what you're doing with your music. And, you know, what's interesting is you're Michael Colon and you're an Italian from Italian heritage. But when I listen to all of your music, boy, do I hear a Celtic vibe. Where did that come from?
Well, you understand, you know, thousands of years ago, the Romans, you know, conquered the British Isles, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the music that is considered Celtic, you know, was, you know, there were a lot of Roman people there. I mean, you know, the British Isles were conquered by the Vikings and the Romans. And, you know, the people, the indigenous folks that were there, of course, you know, they have that absolutely amazing vibration in their music, which we call Celtic music or, you know, the jigs and all of that. But I never really thought of that as exclusive to Ireland or Scotland or England, you know. It's just, I mean, if you listen to the mountain music of Italy, it almost sounds the same as it almost sounds the same of the mountain music in Kentucky or Tennessee.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, you know, I'm just so blown away because you're not just a singer, songwriter, musician. You also do like instrumental music. And I mean, it's just interesting watching the documentary too. One of the themes that I would get from all of the other people that were weighing in on your talent and what you're all about was it sort of like otherworldly, like you just go into this trance and would come out and write songs. And it's almost like they were like lightning bolted into you.
And that became the case after, you know, what I'm going to tell you about that experience I had. But the thing was, when I was a kid, I remember going into a theater And what I went and saw West Side Story, right? Mm. So before I even knew who Bob Dylan was, I wanted to be Leonard Bernstein, you know? I wanted I wanted to compose that great music. I mean, so deeply. I wanted to be a great, classical conductor and composer. And I am really quite a natural composer. I can compose like that, but I was probably the worst music student in the history. I went to Wayne State down in Detroit. As a matter of fact, one of my professors called me an amoeba, just because I was dyslexic and I couldn't read music.
Mm.
I couldn't read music but I always listened to the old sayings. There were some great old sayings like Chet Atkins. Somebody said, "Oh, can you read music, Chet?" He goes, "Not enough to hurt my plane," So I always thought that was a power source,
Yeah. There
Rather than sitting down and trying to recreate something that was written down, I just, everything I did had to be an original composition. Everything. Right. When I was, when I had Prismatic, we had all of these great, great jazz people come in and come on stage with us, and they'd all look and they'd say, "Where's the one? Where's the one?" Because the music was so radical.
Mm-hmm.
And it was radical because I didn't know what I couldn't do.
Wow.
I love that. This amazing creative force, but I had no idea that I couldn't do this or couldn't do that or couldn't do that. I mean, the time signatures and the, just what I was doing with melody and rhythms and stuff like that were pretty radical, really radical, as a matter of fact.
I love it. I love it. It's like it was channeled, which,
exactly. It was all channeled.
Right.
It definitely was channeled. I mean, you saw the film, and at one point I said, when I was doing that, I was surrounded by angelic beings pushing this stuff into me. And I truly and firmly believe that, I was never a linear person. I had this condition that whenever I heard a sound, I would see a color. And I found out that there was a composer previously called Scriabin, and it's called synesthesia, where you hear a sound and you see a color. I have that condition.
That's an extremely rare condition, by the way, that I have.
Oh, absolutely.
It's really cool. There's, when you like people that do have it think that it's super common because you don't understand that we don't have it. Those of us that don't see color.
So, I thought everybody had it.
Right. So here's one of my questions. Okay. So why is this prolific writer, artist, musician on The Next Room tonight, other than to talk about this fascinating music career? Because I'm a music girl first and foremost, but I need to allow Michael to tell about a life-changing event that happened when he was just a boy. And I don't know anything about it. I know a little teeny snippet. So I want you to tell me what happened.
Okay, here's what happened. I lived in the middle of the city of Detroit, but there was 1 square mile around my neighborhood that was all really primal thicket woods. I mean, it was like a woods, almost like Central Park in New York City, right?
What part of Detroit?
I lived over on the northwest side of Detroit, over by 7 Mile Road and Southville, between 7 and 8 Mile Road.
I gotcha.
And the name of the woods was called Pitcher Woods. And it was like this, the Pitcher Woods gang was like this notorious gang, Pitcher Woods was this really amazing forest. It was a wood. And so as I was about, I got kidnapped actually and held hostage in Pitcher Woods for like 4 days one time. I got kidnapped by these crazy, crazy juvenile delinquent hoods,
Oh my goodness.
That was heavy. Anyways, So we were a whole bunch of kids, myself, a couple of my neighbor kids, my older sister, and a couple of her friends. We went out to pick raspberries and blackberries every spring, you know, when those things would grow. It was just amazing. And so I was, you know, crawling around through these. And I don't know if you've ever seen a raspberry bush, but they're like, they've got terrible thorns and
stickers. Oh, they're super thorny.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But so I was like, like some kind of ninja crawling through that stuff. And what happened is I stepped directly on a wasp nest, W-A-S-P, wasp. Disturbed this wasp nest, and they just went ballistic, and I got stung 142 times.
Oh, my gosh.
And if you've ever been stung once by a wasp,
it's terrible.
So painful. It is such a painful thing. 142 times I was stung.
Wow.
And I instantly went into shock. And not only did I go into a shock, but I left my body and I felt, I mean, it was really a cosmic experience because there was a cord to my astral body to my physical body. And that cord was severed. So all of a sudden, it was like a kite string being broken. You know, if you've ever seen a kite string, I mean, if you've ever flown a kite and the string breaks, it just floats off, right? And that's what happened to my spirit. And what they did to my body, and I don't know even how they knew how to do it, but my older sister and Linda Nyquist, some of these other older girls, they took me and they threw me in this mud bath. Mm-hmm. They just submerged me in the mud because our parents weren't home. We were way out in the middle of the woods. There were no adults around or anything. And basically the doctors said that's what saved my life because, you know, any kind of mud, you know, like when they use Aztec clay or any kind of mud or clay, it draws out poisons and impurities, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they submerged me in this mud, which kind of soothed my brain a little bit because of the coolness of the mud. But I was in such intense pain that I left my body, and I remember just hovering. I was just hovering. I was looking down at the whole scene.
Wow.
I could hear people speaking, but I could not participate. And to this day, every time, I always feel like I'm always in the other room. You know, like if we were gathering in the living room, I'm in the kitchen, right? I'm never in the same room as everybody. I'm always detached. I've never gotten back in my body, which has created some kind of awkward social thing, because what it also did, it turned me into, there is no filter between my brain and my mouth, if you will, you know, something in my head, boom, straight out my mouth, unless I use an amazing amount of power, force, and discipline, because I really don't have an editing thing here. You know, I say shit that gets me in so much trouble. And I don't mean, I mean, I'm not trying to be a negative or a mean, nefarious person or anything like that. It's just like I told your friend Nancy, it's almost like I have spiritual Tourette's, you know? I see something and I say it, and everybody looks around and go, "Ooh, that was inappropriate," you know? And so that's what ends up happening to me. I got out of my body and I never got back in. And I mean, that was well over 50 years ago. I never got back in my body. So I'm always hovering, but what it did is it gave me, combined with that synesthesia thing, you know, I was always able to visualize and hear music. And when you watch the documentary and people saying, "God, it was like a lightning bolt got shot into him," that's exactly how it happened. And I mean, I hear a lot of, you know, young, very profound composers, poets, writers, and they go, oh, I channeled it. I channeled it. Well, I didn't channel shit. I was possessed. You know what I mean? If I didn't have the power or the discipline or the brain power to channel anything. It's almost like I watched, you know, that Scorsese thing about Dylan. And one of the producers said, they go, hell, I don't even blame it on Dylan. It's not Dylan that's doing it. It's God that's doing it. I mean, all you got to do is be in the same room with him. And, you know, he's got the Holy Spirit in him, you know?
Right.
And that's how it feels. Not that I'm trying to compare myself to the great Bob Dylan, but it's the same kind of thing. It's like I never had the discipline ever, you know, but I certainly did have the creativity, and I was able to do things that I had no business doing, and able to hear things that I had no business hearing, and see things that I had no business seeing, because I just didn't have the training. So, I mean, I got kicked out of school more than anybody I know for daydreaming, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I went to college, when I went to college and I studied theory, music theory and composition, because I told you I wanted to be Leonard Bernstein, right?
Of course.
But the only reason I went to college is because during that time I was still eligible for the draft. And when we graduated in June, by August, 6-7 of my very dear friends were already dead, killed in Vietnam, right?
Oh, man.
So I'm of that generation that if you went to school, you got a deferment, a 2S deferment.
Mm-hmm.
But the cool thing is, back in those days, they didn't have the computers. Everything was hard copy. So when an 18-year-old kid had to register for the draft, you fill out the forms and they take the papers. And at once a month, at the end of the month, they send it all to Washington and file it all, right? Well, the day I registered for the draft, the White Panther Party, if you remember them, you know, John Sinclair and Pun and all those guys. The White Panther Party blew up my draft board. So I had my registration card, but they had no records of me or who I was.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had a carte blanche to, like, you know, not having to worry about getting drafted because they didn't even know I existed, you know.
Man,
so,
wild.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead.
It was so potent and so powerful. And then, of course, that was only for those few days. Those people who registered within a few days of my birthday, they didn't know where any of us were, right? But then, like I said, so many of my kids, my friends and stuff, or people that I knew, they went straight to Vietnam, and back then it was only 6 weeks basic training. You take a kid out of the city or the suburbs, and you give them basic training at one of the military bases, and then you send them to Southeast Asia. Those people were like, you know, that was their home. They were indigenous jungle people. They knew how to do this guerrilla warfare stuff, and the white kids that went there knew nothing about that. You know, they were sitting ducks. And it had a profound effect upon me and everybody else. It created a really, oh God, it broke so many families. I mean, so many mothers and fathers lost their sons there, you know?
Yeah.
And they had no business, you know, they had no business going there because, I mean, and then if we start talking the political ramifications of that, you know, as they call conflict. But if we start talking about it, you know, like every other war, you know, it was about money. It was about oil. It was about power, all of those things, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, fortunately, you were able to make a living with your guitar, and, you know, I mean, and you still are, you know, which is phenomenal. And sorry to say, but we've got like 1 minute left, and I wanted to play one of your songs, but I was hoping maybe to play a little bit of Peaceful Place, just to kind of give
you
people...
You know, I'm sorry that I talk so much.
No. It's okay. It's good. You know, sometimes it's hard to get people to open up, and you've just got so many great stories, and you've got such a just an incredible career. So if you're tuning in and you're listening, Michael on Fire is my guest. Go to michaelonfire.com. You can listen to his music. If you get a chance, when the documentary is across the country somewhere, it's called The Artist, The Dreamer, The Lover, The Fool. Really extraordinary stuff. Your brother did a great job. I understand that he pretty much produced the doc.
It's his work. Yep. You know, he wrote and produced and directed it. So.
Yeah, he did a wonderful job. Well,
yes, he did.
Michael, I'm thrilled to have you on, and I'm kind of glad that you never returned to your body, because it, you know, I think that it has helped you channel an amazing musical career. And I, for one, I'm a new fan, and I'm originally from Michigan, a little bit younger than you, and I did not know much about you until Nancy started saying, "Jane, you're going to dig this guy, you know, check this out, you know." So I'm glad you came on the show, and we're going to have to say so long because I'm running out of time here. Any closing thoughts?
Just my humble and my gracious thanks to you.
Aw, you're very welcome. I'm glad that you came on the show tonight. And Anthony, producer back in Detroit, if you have a second and you can play a little bit of Peaceful Place on the way out, I think that would be a beautiful way to end this fabulous Next Room interview. Thank you to my guest, Michael on Fire. Please go to michaelonfire.com. You're going to be amazed at what this man has done and continues to do. He's not done yet.